hate these lights when I can't see you, but that's the way it is. It's nice for me to follow what just happened because I once again feel sorry for a philosopher, which is not a common experience. But I come from the bit of the university that still believes in truths at one level. They haven't thought it through, though, and that's science, of course. And I want to talk about culture, what Christianity did in that context. Earlier in my life, spent a long while, 6 or 7 years, working with 10-pound two-year-olds, if you can imagine that, and working out how to treat them. And I was privileged to be part of the group in Jamaica that sorted that out. And so the year I left Jamaica, 1979, we had 100 10-pound two-year-olds or worse come through the unit, and we saved every single one. In other words, we had done the science, and we were doubling their weight in 40 days. Now, this is published, and what result do you expect? Well, of course, you expect that malnutrition in the world will disappear. What has happened? Absolutely nothing. In the next 30 years, nothing has happened. In Africa, it's happened in some other places, but in Africa, there's been no change. In fact, because of HIV, it's got a little worse. I watch the literature every year, and I, every year, used to give my graduate students the task of looking at the world literature to find a nutrition education study that had worked. And in the criteria, had to be the removal of all expatriate input from the community for 3 years. There is no such study. It doesn't exist. It will happen, but not for a while. Why? What's at stake here? This is another aspect of truth we're looking at. When you become a Christian, when Christ comes to you and the veil is lifted and you see the truth, as Paul was talking about, does that make you good? The next morning when you wake up, are you suddenly a different person in practical terms? Well, ask your wife or your husband if you think you are, and they will rapidly correct your illusion. We do not become good overnight, do we? It takes time. Why is that? What's going on here? Well, I think the Bible has a lot to say about this, but we don't read the Old Testament very much now, do we? It's time we did. Because, especially in the developing world, the problem is how you create a culture that is viable. Clearly, it's not working in Africa yet, is it? Every time you open your newspaper, it looks worse. It's not actually worse. It's actually getting better. It's us that are going in the wrong direction. It's certainly getting worse for us as well. There are multiple examples I could use, but the simplest one would be simply to say, when I started in medical school 50 years ago, if I knew 4 sexually transmitted diseases, I couldn't fail finals on that issue. The modern student needs 40 sexually transmitted diseases not to fail finals. That is not progress, is it? Or at least not in the right direction. But the progressives amongst us would say that it is, because it's a direct result of libertarianism. Now, I was persuaded to go to Africa after some years to help a mission group because they had this problem and it wasn't going away. And I didn't want to go because I knew no one had succeeded and I didn't suspect that I would be any different. But we did go. And I could set up a program that would work and my children would do it for me. In fact, all my children when they were teenagers spent their summers resuscitating malnourished children. They had children die in their arms, but it didn't do them any harm. They saved many more. But I could measure the decline in that program from a mere 9-month absence. So clearly there was something missing. Now, nowadays, in these kinds of areas, we build very clever models, our social scientists do, to predict outcomes in various situations. And usually, they're pretty good models. But the striking thing about all the models that were built for predicting malnutrition is that they were very bad models. They never got above 20% explanation levels. So the biggest factor of all was entirely missing. I know what it is. But you can't publish it because it's so politically incorrect. They simply won't publish it. Now, so very shortly after having been there a couple of times, I was sitting around doing nothing from my good wife's point of view. And she's an activist. She likes to get things done, whereas I like to sit and think about what might possibly happen sometime in the distant future that requires me not to remove my seat. And I said, well, I'm thinking. And she said, that looks like doing nothing to me. And I said, that's what thinking looks like to you. And we had a good old-fashioned family row. But as usual, she won. She said, at least you could do some teaching for the university graduates in the village who are unemployed. Now, that was like a 2x4 hitting me over the head. Because even if you've only taken a biochemistry course from me in this culture, by the time you leave, you would go away with a reading list unrelated to biochemistry that would keep you busy for the rest of your life. So you might be unpaid, but you ought never to be employed, unemployed again if I've done a half-decent job. But that was not happening when we sent African graduates to the so-called university, which is actually a multiversity. This is a terrible fact. I can just about see that clock. And I'll go blind in the next 2 minutes. So I said, yeah, I could. And she said, you should do a Bible study on Deuteronomy because that's interesting. And I did. And it was interesting. One of those wonderful things that only God can do began quite quickly. It was done in bad French on my part and good French on Sally's part. Between us, we managed all right. But then one of the Africans said, it's a pity we can't go from English to the tribal language directly. And then one of them said, but we can. And a man had actually walked 1,000 kilometers to get to me without knowing why. He spoke good English. He'd been born in that tribe, so he spoke the tribal language, but he'd been educated in Tanzania, where English was the common currency of education. He was a Muslim originally, and a few months before, he had become disenchanted with Islam, and he began to have a dream telling him to go to the Christians. And the dream was so persistent that he eventually gave in. He only needed to hear the gospel once, and the veil was lifted, and he was baptized on the spot. A few months later, he had another dream telling him to go back to Zaire. So he walked all the way around Lake Tanganyika to get there. He was a few miles away from where I was, waiting. He didn't know what he had to do. Africans are much more patient than we are. He became my translator. An amazing experience. What was so important about this? What made it interesting? Well, I don't suppose many of you could, apart from Paul and one or two others, could tell me what Deuteronomy 6 is about, right? It's not exactly your favorite passage in the scriptures, is it? But it is, in fact, central to Judaism, and its context has a great deal to say to us. It's the Shema Israel. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your might. Mind is not there, because Jews didn't need to put it there. Jesus uses the Leviticus one, not the Deuteronomy one, because he knew about us. We separated mind and heart. We need to bring them back together again. But what comes next? How many of you, raise your hand if you could complete the verse, without looking it up, of course, with that machine in front of you. I even talked about it for a year or two afterwards without realizing I'd missed an important point. I talked about teaching it to your children, which is there. Any of you notice what precedes that? You can only teach it to your children if it is upon your heart. These two characteristics of real teaching, that you must love the child and you must love what you're teaching. And this is where the church has gone wrong. It's Father's job to do this. And when this gets lost, the culture is on its way out. So we're on its way out. Arnold Toynbee, the great British historian, wrote a book towards the end of his life called An Historian Looks at Religion. And in it, he fingered six things. I think it's six. We'll see when I've listed them. You can tell me that it's six or five. Doesn't really matter. Which are the determinants, or not determinants, the indicators of when a culture is on the skids and about to disappear. He studied over 20 cultures during his lifetime. He says the first thing that happens when a culture is about to disappear is that it loses its sense of moral consensus. It no longer believes that you can know what good and evil are in a way that everybody agrees. Alan Bloom was writing about that. That's certainly true of us, isn't it? So that's one down and a few to go. Of course, when we no longer agree about good and evil, and political parties change, the legislation reflects different views of good and evil. And naturally, when your party is not in power, you have diminishing respect for the laws they make. But a society where large groups of people begin to disrespect the law is bound to become unstable. And that's what happens. Things start to fall apart. In that most famous poem of the 20th century, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. So what happens next? Well, of course, when you wake up and look at the country you love and that you don't love what it's doing, now you begin to really feel bad about it. You don't enjoy being you. So you start escaping from the world. Drugs and alcohol or some equivalent begins to grow. Is that happening? Oh yes, hugely. We're not doing well, are we? The next thing that happens, of course, is that you hate yourself because you're not doing anything about stopping this, largely because you don't know how to. And of course, this is where we are in medicine at the moment. The things that we have to deal with, even in pediatrics, cutting, tattooing, hatred of the body, even the horrendous epidemic of plastic surgery that women are submitting themselves to, instead of learning to grow old gracefully, because God has a new body for you. My wife and I are at the stage where we discuss quite frequently which bit of our body is going to disappear next, so to speak. You know, it's the dysfunction grows by the day. But the good news is there's a new one coming. But most people are not living that way anymore. And the obsession with appearance and with fashion, it's all part of this process of trying to deal with self-hatred. It's not the way to go. That goes on down the next stage, doesn't it? You can see what's going to happen next. Despair sets in. I mean, it doesn't make much sense, does it, for the Americans to propose democracy for the world when they can't get 50% of their population out to vote on most cases. And I see you have some sort of local election going on here. I imagine 20% will vote, and then we'll complain about the results. That's not really very rational, is it? And then finally, promiscuity, both intellectual and sexual. Students can hold logically incompatible ideas in their head with no problem at all. Paul just gave you the examples of those sentences which ought to cause laughter immediately if they had even the most basic training in logic. And they don't. One of our graduates from Augustine last year is in McMaster now in the pre-med program. And the guy comes along to teach biopsychosocial medicine. And his first overhead, a professor being paid, is there are no absolutes. Nathan immediately raises his hand, which doesn't normally happen in first year university. And the prof looks up a bit surprised, and he says exactly what Paul said. Is that sentence internally consistent? Now, as here, you see, if you were medieval monks, you would all have been laughing. But because you're not medieval monks, you don't understand the joke. The joke is that the sentence is stupid. And the student was telling the professor, that's a stupid sentence. Fortunately, the guy was smart enough to realize he was completely beaten and did the only thing you can do then, which is to climb down graciously and say, thank you, it is a stupid sentence, isn't it? I must remove it. But that a student should have to do that shows how far this issue has gone on truth. We're in deep trouble. And of course, I don't need to say anything about sexual promiscuity these days. Youth pastors tell me that they don't expect more than one in six couples in an evangelical church to come to the altar virginal. That is a disaster for all of us, because it means society is unstable. I normally talk about this under the title, Why Are There No Hittites on the Streets of New York? The title intrigues people. It's stolen from Walker Percy, but it's true. The Hittites were a huge empire. They stretched from northern Israel to the other side of the Black Sea. In the 19th century, smart professors used them as evidence that the Bible was fabricated because there was no evidence of the Hittites. Then we dug them up. Never build your arguments on negatives. You're highly likely to be proven wrong, which is what happened. But there are no Hittites in the world, but there are Jews. And the difference, they will tell you, is Deuteronomy. That's why it matters. Deuteronomy is about what follows belief. After all, the children of Israel, they had a pretty exciting conversion, so to speak, didn't they? You may have had an exciting one, but I doubt that it involved God speaking to you in an audible voice, accompanied by a small volcano and a large amount of noise and all the rest. If you were at Mount Sinai, you didn't have any free will after that was over. Everybody who was there lost their free will, didn't they? There was no question of not believing in God after that experience. But did it make them good? No. They broke the first three commandments in order while Moses was still up the mountain. And Moses comes down and he says, God heard what you said. But he also knew what you were going to do. They had said, we will obey, as I suspect you did when you got converted. And you haven't, and they didn't. God said, oh, that they would have such a heart and mind as this to keep my law, but they will not. Note that it's mind. After this service, I hope that there will be a change in the normal verbal usage that happens after church on Sunday morning. You know what I'm talking about? Your pastor does. The normal conversation is, how do you feel, right? What should it be on Sunday morning? It should be, how do you think? It is your pastor's job on Sunday morning to come and make you think better. I can even in an Anglican church get away with misquoting the scriptures like this. Paul wrote the epistles for practical reasons because the church was screwing up most of the time. And he thinks that theology can solve the problem. So he says at the end of an epistle typically something like this. If you have followed my argument, then you ought not to be like the people around you, but to be transformed by the renewal of your feelings. Now, there are a few of you who understand what I just did. Nothing very much, really. I merely trashed the whole history of the church in one sentence, and most of you don't care or don't know. It doesn't say that, does it? It says you must be transformed by the renewal of your mind, the way you think. And, of course, when you start thinking clearly about what the Bible says, is that a pleasant experience? It is not, is it? Because it's a tough book. When you think well, you feel terrible. And that's why your pastor finds it hard to make you think well, because he doesn't want you to go home to Sunday lunch feeling terrible because you might not come back to church. But he ought to fear God more than he fears you. You should come to church expecting to feel terrible. You will feel good when you are obedient. Feelings are in God's province, not ours. Don't even bother about them. They're not important in that level because you cannot do anything about them. Your feelings, we come, we know not where nor where they go in any real sense. They're God's province, not ours. And he can provide you with good feelings anywhere he wishes. He can do that totally independent of the environment. The best summer of my life in terms of subjectivity was the summer of 1995, a summer I will never forget. Where was I that summer? Well, my wife had been running refugee camps following the Rwanda War, 4 or 5 of them. I can't remember how many, actually. And I went out to see her in the summer of 95, not having seen her when she'd come home briefly, in body at least, at Christmas. And I got there. She knows I don't suffer from jet lag. And so the next day, I found myself talking to the leaders of the refugee camps. The net result of all this was that I ended up teaching in the refugee camps for the whole of that summer. I guess it was probably 3 to 6 hours every other day for 2 months. I was the happiest man in the world, in the most unhappy place. They were in tears, and I was in tears. But I was doing what I was made for. In one sense, for the very first time, because I had got to that stage in my life. That's over 50. Before I said to God, this summer is yours with no strings attached. Many of us do Christian things in the summer, but who decides which Christian things we will do? We do, don't we? That's the difference. It's very important to make the distinction between doing good things because you want to do them and doing them the other way around. My time is up. 5 minutes. If you want to leave, you can. I mean, I can't see you anyway, so it's all right. Let me give you an example of what's at stake here in a beautiful way. We were in Kenya a couple of weeks ago. I was teaching at Tenwick Hospital there. And the guy who runs it, the surgeon who's in charge of the hospital, a wonderful man called Russ White, told me a lovely story about what happens when God does things as opposed to you. He's a surgeon, and like most surgeons, he thinks he's more competent than he is. He had a child come in who was having great difficulty breathing. And when I say great difficulty breathing, I really mean that. The child was at death's door. A mother had a story that the child had swallowed something, a bean, I think it was. And obviously, the breathing problem was so bad, it must have lodged exactly at the bifurcation of the trachea. So the only thing to do is put a tube down and see if you can get it out. This was a few years ago, and he hadn't got any modern equipment for pediatrics of the soft variety. The only tube he'd got that would go down there was a rigid steel tube that normally goes down the esophagus. But at least he got it in. But he couldn't see anything, and he'd only had it in for a few seconds when the child's heart stopped. So he pulled it out quickly and started the heart again. He did that 3 times. Didn't get anything. And he said to the people who were there, if we don't get this thing out, the child dies. But every time I put the tube down, she dies too. The only thing we do is surgery, but she's probably going to die before I can get to the carina, but we have to try. I'll go and scrub up while you get the equipment out. And while he was scrubbing up, he said, God spoke to me. He said, I've never had an experience quite like this, but he spoke to me. I'm not sure it was words, but it doesn't matter. He said, do it again. And he said, I actually answered back. I said, that's the most stupid thing I've heard for a long while. I've just done it 3 times and the child died every time. And God said, yes, that's because you did it. Now go and do it again, and I'll do it this time. And he was overwhelmed. He went back and said, we're going to do it one more time. And as he reached for the tube, he looked across the OR and he saw a bit of equipment that he hadn't thought about because it's not used for this purpose. It was lying around at the side. He said, give me that. It's a thing that we normally use for getting stones out of the ureter, from the kidney to the bladder. And he said, we'll put this down first. They said a prayer and put it down, opened up the basket, pulled, and there was the bean. And the child woke up in about 2 minutes and looked around, wondering where on earth she was. Ross went out to the mother and said, your child died, and I didn't bring her back to life. Jesus did. And that led to the mother's conversion and another story I haven't time to tell at this point. But the nature of how we live and how our virtues are created has a lot to do with how we think about our duties. And what Moses goes on to say to the children of Israel in Deuteronomy 5 and 6, he reminds them that the law has no power in itself because they can't keep it. And following the Shema Israel, he says, these things shall be upon your heart and you teach them to your children. Now, Paul and I and others here grew up in Christian homes. And that's where our virtues come from, in my view, to a large extent. You cannot make your children Christian. But if father tells all the stories of the Bible to the children before the age of 7, you're highly likely to produce good citizens. That's the way it works. You inhabit stories. Now, in Africa, I couldn't make malnutrition work, and neither can anyone else, because Africans are new Christians. They've been saved in a fading pagan story, which has no space for science, no space for nutrition education. Its explanatory power is based on evil spirits. And there's quite a lot of Christians who are going that way again. Their power has been taken away long since. We are new soft nihilists in a fading Christian story. And that is our problem. And we're not attacking it. And we have to begin to do so. And the first thing that's needed is that we begin to get our children to live inside the stories. And I haven't time to go into that, but I can illustrate it so that you can go away and do it. My favorite way of doing it, I think I may have used it here already, but so be it. I've been fairly busy in the last 2 or 3 weeks. The last telegram that was sent from the beaches of Dunkirk to London at the beginning of the Second World War was just 3 words. It arrived in London and it was immediately understood. The words are, "But if not." Raise your hand if you understand the message. Paul does. It's a very famous one. He should know it. He could get fired if he didn't. Not quite, but. And you know it too, actually. It goes like this. "Be it known unto you, King Nebuchadnezzar, our God is able to save us from the fiery furnace, but if not, we will not bend the knee." Isn't that an amazing telegram to send under those circumstances? But how much more amazing, it was immediately understood in London. Why? Because when Sally and I went to school, for 12 years, school began every day, not with a prayer alone, but with a chapter from the Bible and a prayer. And in my environment, often a creedal statement and a short sermon from the chief master, we frequently felt we needed it. That meant that in the peak learning period of your life, the Bible was put in place. So while that education persisted, you could not leave the first 12 years of education biblically illiterate. It was a disaster to remove the Bible from school, not just for religious reasons, that's disastrous, but that shouldn't have been the argument. Because even for a secular society, you could argue that the Bible stories are important and they need to be taught because they are where we derive our ideas of good and evil from and the way we ought to behave. That's Alan Bloom's point again. This is the way he puts it at the end of the first chapter of that book, The Closing of the American Mind, about 3 paragraphs from the end. Here he is, a professor in the University of Chicago who teaches philosophy, brilliant teacher. A third-generation Jew in America. His grandparents had arrived with nothing. They worked in the sweatshops. His parents owned the sweatshops. And he and his cousins, as he puts it, were all MDs or PhDs. The typical Jewish success story. But he knows that the American world is falling apart. He is getting students he cannot teach because they have no biblical literacy. And so the metaphors that he needs are not understood. And he's looking back on this history, and he says of his grandparents, "My grandparents were humble folk. They never went to university, never went, as he put it, into an institution of higher learning. But everything done in their home was spiritually rich. Everything they did was rooted in the book. And in that book, the Old Testament, they could find a myriad of exemplary heroes that enabled them to perform their duties and bear their sorrows. And they could go to the synagogue, where they heard great scholars who spoke not from an alien perspective, but from the same perspective, while simply going deeper and providing guidance. That, he says brilliantly, is what a community is. It's a brilliant definition of a community. A community is something that invites high and low into the same story of meaning. We don't have a common story of meaning, even within the church now, because we don't know. We're biblically illiterate, even as Christians. But it was the next sentence that had a profound effect on me, because he says, when I look at my cousins, all of whom are professional MDs and PhDs, they have no wisdom comparable to that of their grandparents. When they speak of the meaning of life, the relationship between husbands and wives, how to bring up children, life and death, they speak in the language of cliché. They have no wisdom. And that is the church's problem, that we treat conversion as though it is a completed activity. It isn't. Let me misquote St. Paul again. Misquoting scripture is a very good way to teach, isn't it? So you better be paying attention. And I want you to raise your hand if you realize what I'm doing. I made it easy for you. I should do it without telling you I'm going to misquote. That's the really good teaching tool. But I'm being kind to you. Time is up, actually. Paul says, the preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who have been saved, it is the power of God. Raise your hand if you know what I've done to you. Again, I've merely trashed Christian cultural history. Do you want a second try? It looks as though no one knows. Anyway, let's try once more. Paraphrasing also helps, of course. The preaching of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who have been saved, it is the power of God. Anyone? What is it? That's right. I heard it very dimly. I'm getting old, curmudgeonly, and deaf. But it's to those who are being saved. It's meant to be present continuous as well as a completed action in the past. We tend to wrap it up in fancy words like sanctification, but in many ways it would be better to think of it as Paul expresses it there. Could you turn to your neighbor now and ask them to praise God with you for a way in which you were saved last week? That's what, instead of passing the peace every Sunday, we should say, turn to your neighbor and talk about the way Christ intervened in your life in salvation this week. That's quite a thought, isn't it? That's what happens when you start to realize that that whole way of life is deeply rooted in a Christianity that we ourselves have forgotten, and we certainly don't know how to defend in the university. You will never teach a pagan to do nutrition education, because it's unthinkable if the world is controlled by evil spirits. It is not possible to do that. We as Christians are more committed to our technique than we are to working out the power of the gospel. So we go to a place like Africa. I've seen it dozens of times. And nice people like you arrive for a short-term mission, and they watch women pounding corn for 8 hours a day. And so the next time they come, if they're naive, they bring a small mill from North America. If they're smarter, they buy one in Bujumbura, which at least will be the right voltage. And then they present it to the village, and there's great celebration. But it won't be running, usually in less than a year, because the very idea of maintenance is not thinkable to somebody who explains reality in terms of evil spirits. We have got the whole thing upside down. We don't realize how deeply the Lord has influenced the whole of our culture. Christ came at the right time, Kairos, when Greek learning and Roman pragmatism met Jewish theology, the world changed. As one of my friends put it so beautifully, and he published this, he's a journalist, on the leader page of the Ottawa Citizen. The article was called, Why Taking the Cross Seriously Can Make You Very Cross. And he began by saying, where Greek learning, Roman pragmatism, and Jewish theology met, some fishermen, a tax collector, and a man who had a seizure on the road to Damascus persuaded the whole Roman Empire that a dead Jewish carpenter is God. How weird is that? This man was not a Christian when he wrote that. We had lunch together every now and again. And at the end he says, the problem for me as an atheist is that it looks as though I must read the scriptures before I decide that Augustine, Aquinas, and C.S. Lewis were stupid. And I'm rather afraid that if I do, I may lose the argument. But could we make the argument? Do we know our history well enough to do it? I think the answer is no. I think you have something to talk about. And I also think you'll probably have a little repentance to do. Thank you.